Now it's my pleasure to welcome all of you to Complementary and Alternative Medicine. This morning's session will be presented by Dr. Terry Harville. Dr. Harville is an Associate Professor of Pathology at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences and Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the Arkansas Children's Hospital, both in Little Rock, Arkansas. In addition, he is Medical Director for the Special Immunology Laboratory and Molecular Diagnostics Laboratory at Arkansas Children's Hospital, and Medical Director for the Histocompatibility Laboratory and the Immunogenetics and Transplantation Laboratory. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Harville.
I guess the lavalier is not going to work. Thank you very much, Kara. It's always a pleasure to be able to come to the IDF meetings. And I appreciate the IDF inviting me. This is a new topic. We'll have to see how it goes, and hopefully we'll be able to make some sense of a variety of issues today. And as Kara noted, I don't mind interruptions because I don't know that what I have to say is more interesting than what you might ask. That may actually be provide more information that is more interest of the people that are here. This was a broad topic of which there's a lot that can be said, and a lot that I will not have an opportunity to say today. As we think about this and thinking about what's going on, this one of the things that sort of come out to me when I heard about the topic was. Because there's good things, there's bad things, and some of it gets a little bit ugly as time goes on. What I want to do today is first I'm going to give some disclaimers about the talk. I'm not really an expert in this area, and we'll be using CAM as the abbreviation for Complementary Alternative Medicine. I know a few things, and hopefully I can answer some of the things that may be of interest to you. This is always something best done one-to-one so that you can actually talk about the things that are relevant to the individual. And in a talk where you're trying to give to a general audience, you may not cover the topics that someone is really wanting to hear. So again, ask the questions, give the pages. I'm going to be here afterwards to discuss things that people have to ask about. As mentioned, there's really no way to discuss everything in 45 minutes or so. And you need to not do this. What I mean by that is the disclaimer is this on different things is don't do this at home. Make sure you are getting the right advice. You're talking things over with your physician, your immunologist, before you embark further. And I'll go into more details about that during the talk. But make sure that what I'm trying to say there is make sure you know what you're doing, the ramifications of it. Don't go into something blindly because you think somebody somewhere had said something that might make it useful. Make sure you're not hurting yourself. For today's talk, I'm going to go over a few definitions. I'm going to give a couple of cases. I divide things out in sort of minerals, vitamins, amino acids, other types of supplements, essential oils, probiotics, and then some other alternative and also complementary forms, chiropractic care, acupuncture, and hypnotism. I'll touch on a variety of these areas, so obviously I can't go into great depth on anything. This is the definition of complementary and alternative medicine from the Merck Manual. So complementary alternative medicine, CAM, refers to healing approaches and therapies that are not based on principles of mainstream conventional medicine. That's generally why people go into this, because they're not getting the help that they were looking for otherwise. The complementary medicine in particular refers to unconventional practice used with mainstream. So that's adding things to what you're already doing in mainstream, whereas alternative medicine refers to doing unconventional practices instead of the mainstream. So that's how the definitions of these go along. And we're going to follow that kind of approach to the context of these. The other thing to mention is what's called integrative medicine, and this is healthcare that uses all the approaches that one can put together, both the conventional and alternative, within a framework that can actually work for a patient. So that's not being judgmental about something that you're not sure about, but if it's not harmful to the patient, add it and see if it provides benefit. And so that's been my approach for the ones that know me and I've helped with, is that we try to integrate whatever is helpful for the patient. I want to start with a term that's thrown about a lot, and that's homeopathy. And this is something that you have to be careful about when you see the word, because homeopathy comes from an old concept in which a substance that would cause a symptom. So, for example, if you take Ipecac, that will make you vomit. That was something used to make you vomit. And so if you take something like Ipecac that would make you vomit, then you dilute it down to, so it's very, 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 very dilute. The concept was it would cause the opposite effect. So something makes you vomit, you dilute it, it will stop vomiting. Something that makes a fever, dilute it, would stop the fever. And so that's what homeopathy is about. And the thing that occurs, though, when you try to look for the compound in the dilution, it's not there. So generally, a substance that you've diluted can't be detected anymore. So usually homeopathy is safe. The reason it's safe is that you're drinking water. And what's thought to occur is the memory of the substance in the water is still there to provide the countering effect. So when somebody's using homeopathy as the old-fashioned way of using it, you may just be buying expensive diluted water. So traditionally, the homeopathy really has no benefit. You're just getting water. You're getting a placebo effect. More recently, though, we've sort of taken this term to be used in the context of home remedies. Now, as a home remedy, that's a whole different issue. So you have to make sure if you're going to someplace that sells homeopathy, or they're selling you diluted water, or actually buying something that has some true substance and validity to it. So always make sure of what you're getting in there with it. And again, beware, because if they're practicing traditional homeopathy, you'll pay a lot of money for water. Natural remedies, I think, are what a lot of us are thinking about. So natural remedies or natural medicines. And I think that's what most of us think we'd rather have than a medicine that has lots of other adverse side effects that we don't want to have occurring. And this has occurred over thousands of years where natural substances that were found out in the world, people would eat or drink or apply to their body somehow, and some of these would be effective at alleviating some kind of a problem. And so over time, by just observation, some of these things actually turn out to be very useful. And indeed, some of these things down the line are what have been converted to drugs and medications that we use now in conventional medicine. So many of the natural remedies are actually very beneficial and provide good use. And the best example of this is what we call traditional Chinese medicine. And so for 5,000 years, they've been looking at all kinds of different compounds and products that are found in nature and trying these in various forms, and many of these actually do work and provide some benefit to you. But again, if you're seeking this out, you need to find somebody that is schooled in traditional Chinese medicine, not somebody that took a two-week email course somewhere that can put up the sign, because they probably aren't going to be that helpful to you. The other thing to think about when, and so this is issues, is that because of the nature of complementary and alternative medicine, that people are trying to sell you something. So, and frequently it's sold via testimonials. And so somebody will stand up there and says, I could not walk and I started drinking this stuff or rubbing this on my legs and now I can walk again. And that doesn't have a lot of validity to it. And so most of the things haven't really been studied in what we call a rigorous scientific fashion. Now there's problems with that too. They may use the wrong dosage, the wrong cyclic compounds, and so you have to sift through a lot of information to come away with a better feeling for what's truly going on with these things. But again, when somebody's trying to sell you something in this matter, just remember that on the other end, they're trying to make a profit. And what happens to individuals, especially with conditions like this room is filled with, is that routine medicine that we'd call allopathic medicine may not be providing all the benefit that's needed. And therefore, it's easy for people to fall prey to somebody that's selling them a snake oil that they think is going to be beneficial because they're looking for something. They're looking for something that's going to make them well. And so always be careful about this. Be very, very careful. And again, when you're seeking help and you're desperately seeking to try to find other things, it's easy to become a victim to a snake oil salesman. So try to always sort through and keep the emotions out from the testimonies and so forth, and look for the real validity there. And then always ask someone, you know, ask me, ask your physician, ask somebody what our thoughts are. We may not know, and we can look into it and then maybe give you a better answer about what's going on. And then in the issue context, in sort of the opposite vein, what we practice as modern allopathic medicine is new. It's not what's been going on for thousands of years. We've taken some of the important things and then put those into here, but basically what we're doing is relatively new. For example, antibiotics have only been around for 65 years or so, yet for hundreds and thousands of years, people have found natural compounds that actually would function and work as an antibiotic. And that's where we get our antibiotics from. The first antibiotics were discovered by microorganisms found in soil. So there is something to natural medicine, home remedies, and so forth. But it's always sorting out the truth from the facts and the truth from the things that are trying to just be sold. So once again, thousands of years, there's observations been made, and these natural products, many of them will work, and some are good. The problem we have with most natural products in this country is very little regulation. And so what can end up is that you have something that's labeled something, but that's not what it really is. And what's happened recently, for example, you may have heard about in the last few weeks from the state of New York, the Attorney General tested products from very reputable businesses that sell alternative medicines, sell complementary medicines, sell supplements. And, for example, they couldn't find what was listed on the label as being in the label, but did find compounds that were potentially very toxic in there. And this is very problematic, especially when you're buying from a place you think is good. Yes?
I'm just wondering, are alternative medicines
standardized
in other countries?
No. For the most part, it's totally unregulated. In China, it's unregulated per se, but you have people that practice for such a long time that train under a master, as it were, and so the tradition is carried forward, and they're trying to do a good job, and they're not in it to make money, and so therefore it's practiced in a much different form. Finally, and I'll probably repeat this several times, buyer beware. So what I want to start with is exactly what I told you not to depend on, that's testimonials. So I'm going to give you a couple of cases to describe some issues and how that plays into the whole context here. And so I'm going to start with a 15-year-old young man, and he has an antibody deficiency. And he got sent to me for the second, probably third or fourth or fifth or whatever opinion, because he had this non-healing wound of the abdomen. So for 3 or 4 years, he'd had a wound that remained open, would not heal up. Had been treated with antibiotics, both oral IV, had been hospitalized and put on IV antibiotics for several days or weeks without clearing of it. They were treating with acetic acid washes, so wash it every day, put packings in it, do all this kind of thing. He got put in hyperbaric oxygen to see if that would heal it. Nothing was healing it. And this had gone on, again, for several years. He was on IVIG, and it was appropriate dosing, but interesting to me, he needed to get IVIG every 2 weeks to keep his levels up. So that was something telling me there's something amiss here, up there. And what was going on also is he was motivated. Why? He had just got a girlfriend, and she didn't like the smell coming from his belly, and she was afraid to hug him because she didn't know what that would do. And he decided he wanted to get this healed up so he could actually hug his girlfriend. And his mother had heard from a friend that had heard something about an alternative treatment that said beer fat, when you put on wounds like this, would heal them up. And it's like, well, I'm not sure we want to go that route. Let's look at things and let's think about what's going on and see if there's something we might could do otherwise. So we looked through his labs. What's called the MCV was very low. That suggests there's an iron deficiency. And he was iron deficient. He had a low albumin, a low prealbumin. And also, because he needed IVIG every 2 weeks, it suggested to me that he was protein deficient, that he was not getting enough protein in. He didn't have enough protein to do things like, for example, heal a wound. And there are a lot of other things, and I won't go to all, but basically it's for nutrition. So talk to him, okay, what do you eat? Oh, that's easy. I drink a six-pack of Pepsi and eat a bag of Doritos. That's what he did every day. So no wonder he was had poor nutrition, and that had been going on for several years. And so my diagnosis was he had poor wound healing due to the malnutrition, not due to his CVID, not to these other things, that this was a distinct and separate issue from that, although everyone else had placed it underneath his CVID. So what do we do for that? Well, he had a girlfriend, so he was motivated. So I said, we're going to do 7,000 calories a day of Ensure. That's a lot of cans. I forgot to calculate the number of cans, but he, you know, there's no way he could drink that, and he wasn't even willing to drink it. So I said, we'll put an NG tube down, and we'll do it that way. Well, he didn't want to keep the NG tube down all day long, so we used one of the rigid type NG tubes rather than a soft one, and he would put it down his nose every night, and basically learn how to sword swallow. And he thought that was pretty neat, actually, every night, swallow this down. And so we'd give him the 7,000 calories, plus we gave him vitamins and iron and all the other things he was missing from nutritionally otherwise. And within 2 months, this is, he healed up totally. Just totally healed. Been going on for several years. All because of poor nutrition. And he didn't need an alternative approach like beer fat. He needed to have the people look at what was going on and give the right approach to the therapy. So proper nutrition is critical. So the complementary alternative method was not required per se, but this was actually a form of CAM because it was using alternative approaches to manage what was going on that was slightly outside what other people would consider the box for therapy. Let's go to another case here. So this was a little 8-year-old boy that I saw, and this was a number of years ago, and he had juvenile arthritis. At that time, we didn't have a lot of the medicines we have now, and so we treated him with aspirin. And aspirin worked very well in children with juvenile arthritis. Well, his mother wanted to use white willow, which is basically a source of aspirin, and you brew it down as a tea, and you drink the tea. So I said, okay, well, we can look into it. And so arrangements were made to talk with the manufacturer, the people that made the white willow bark. Actually, their manufacturing was very good. They tested it. They knew what was in it. They knew all the compounds that were present. So they could tell you what you were getting from that. And so I said, okay, we can look at this, and we can decide whether or not this is going to be practical. So we call them. We talk to them. And we're going to need roughly about 35 or 40 baby aspirins a day, which would turn out to be 9 or 10 adult-size aspirins a day. So we talked with the manufacturer about what was going on. He made the calculations of this, and looking at what the salicylate was in their product, and then talked to us and said, okay, if you brew the bark from a tree every day, you can get enough aspirin to treat him and all. So the problem with that is there are a lot of other chemicals there. He said, you know, that would probably kill him because they're quite toxic if you were to brew all those out in a day. So this would have been quite expensive to do that much willow bark a day. So while this was a potential approach, it wasn't practical to deal with in this setting. So he even told her, why don't you do what the doctor's telling you? Use the aspirin, because that's going to work. Aspirin's a natural product. It came from a plant to begin with. So what's the difference whether you take it from the, you know, try to use the plant directly or you use something that's refined from the plant? And in this case, taking it refined from the plant, we know what we're doing. We know what the dosage is. We know what the side effects are and everything else to deal with there. So even though there may be a natural remedy that could have the ingredient you need for a treatment, it may not be in the correct form, may not be the sufficient dosing, and there may be toxic material with it. So just because you're trying to take some alternative or supplemental medication or some type of a thing, that the other stuff in there may not be good for you, as well as what the label's saying is there, you don't know what the dosage is, and so you may not be getting the dosage that you really think that you are or what you really need. So let's move through these things relatively quickly as I can. Again, as we mentioned, you can stop me to ask specific things. And I can't tell you everything in this limited talk, so I'm just going to mention some of the highlights of things. So when we think about minerals, iron, calcium, magnesium, manganese, iodine, potassium, zinc, copper, phosphorus are some of the major ones. Most of these would come in our diet if we're not just drinking Pepsi and eating Doritos. We'd probably get most of these that would be helpful for us. There are other ones that may have some benefit in use, such as selenium, vanadium, and chromium, but these can also lead to toxicities when you have too much of them. And indeed, any of these things in too much could be potentially toxic. And so we always have to be careful about, even on supplements that we need, is not overloading on things. And I'll show you a couple slides that will help describe that further. So we do need minerals, and sometimes we need supplementing because we either are low on them or we lose them. Women, via menstruation and having had childbirth and so forth, usually are going to be deficient on iron and deficient on calcium. And so those really do need to be supplemented. But many others will also be deficient on these, either from because of lack of diet or medicines they've used that have depleted these things, or a variety of reasons. But we can test for these to determine what your needs really are. So a balanced diet should work, but we can test and determine, especially rare types of things like copper, and make sure you're getting enough of it and not being overloaded with it to an extent that could cause some toxicity. And calcium, everybody needs to take probably supplemental-wise, but calcium doesn't do any good unless you also take magnesium. And in addition, nowadays, because most of us aren't outside all the time, we need vitamin D with that. So for calcium to actually work, you need to have magnesium and vitamin D with it. So if you have a low calcium and you take calcium, it's probably not going to give you the benefit you need. Yes?
A lot of the supplements now
have magnesium in them. Is there any validity to that? Mm-hmm. Magnesium causes muscle relaxation and can reduce pain intensity. Magnesium, before other medicines were available, if you give intramuscular magnesium, like a gram of it, you can stop somebody that's having a seizure from seizing. And mothers that were having preeclampsia, you give magnesium to reduce their blood pressure and their chance for having seizures. The babies come out what we call a floppy baby because they're just like this. And we usually have to put them on a ventilator for a day or two because they have no effort at all to breathe because they're so relaxed. Magnesium is very relaxing. The downside, which can be good in some people, is it also is very anti-constipative. And so if you have problems with constipation, taking magnesium is great because you no longer have problems with constipation. But if you're already on the diarrheal side, it may influence that to be a little bit more loose. But 500 to 1,000 milligrams of magnesium a day is something that's pretty good, but will cause loose stools. Pardon? No, magnesium for the relaxation can work by itself. For calcium to work, you need magnesium. Okay? So what's happened now more recently, though, is calcium supplements in particular are telling you that's going to cause you to have a heart attack, especially if you're over age 55 or 60. Okay, the problem with that is if you're also going to have problems with osteoporosis. So, you know, pick your disease. Do you want to have your bones deteriorate or you want to have a heart attack? So, it's very bothersome to me because of the issues there. The cardiologists now are telling their patients to stop taking the calcium supplements. Their other physicians that are involved with them are saying you need your calcium for your osteoporosis. So, this is something that needs to be worked out. I think you can do this in moderation and get the benefit that you need, especially when you add the magnesium and vitamin D to it. Then you're not having to take those massive amounts of calcium to get the benefit from it. Zinc is something that's also very interesting. Zinc is absolutely required for wound healing. Why does the animal lick their wounds? That's because it activates calcium to start the healing process. That's why in the old days, when somebody had wounds, and even in the Bible they mention it, about the dogs coming over licking the wounds, people used to seek out the dogs to lick their wounds to get them to heal up. The reason is they had the zinc there that would help start the activation process to cause the healing. All right, so it's very good. And people can get benefit from taking zinc, especially if they're deficient in zinc. But you can also join the lawsuit against the zinc that's in the paste that's used to keep dentures in, where they said people got toxic from this tiny amount of zinc that was present in the paste. So again, there's this dichotomy that doesn't necessarily make sense. They're diametrically opposed for things in there. So again, one has to be careful about things. Vitamins. So let me talk about these very quickly. And again, focusing on just a few. So the B, C, D, and folic acid are something we probably need in supplements. These are water soluble. They go out in our body, they go out of our body. And so you can't really hurt yourself too much except for possibly the D. Let me rephrase. The D actually is not water soluble. D is more of a fat soluble vitamin. The BC and folic acid are the water soluble vitamins. So let me clarify that, what I just said. So the V vitamins, though, are required in all kinds of processes we have in our body, and it's very difficult to overdose on those. So you're not going to hurt yourself by taking extra V. The problem with some of the Bs, as I'll mention in a moment, like B12, if you don't, if some things are wrong in your intestines, the B12 is not getting into you. So you can be taking massive amounts and not getting any benefit from it. And I'll go over that in a little bit more in just a second here. One of the things that's very interesting about these, again, they're lost in urine, and people that think that taking vitamin supplements and everything is sort of hoodoo or is a waste of time, effort, and money, or what I would just simply call a detractor of these things, will say that people that take vitamin B have very expensive urine, and that they should recover their urine and re-drink it or something to get their B vitamins back. But because it's a loss, and it's true. You take these supplements, you're going to be losing them. And so is it worth it? Is it worth the expense? Those are things people individually have to work through. The B12, as I was mentioning, is not well absorbed in many individuals. The monthly injections, and so some of you may remember the old-timey family doctors that would come by and give the vitamin B shots to grandma or somebody every month. Those work. Those are helpful. Those are very good for people. The sublingual approach under the tongue can be helpful in many people, but you still may not be getting as much as you would from the injection. And the other thing to mention is if you're taking B12, you really do need the folic acid. You need both of those together. So like the calcium, magnesium, vitamin D combination needs to be used together, that your B12, your B vitamins really need to go with the folic acid to get the full benefit that you need from those. Yes?
So if you get B12 injection, mm-hmm. Is the folic acid in there?
No, you take the folic acid separately. B12 is absorbed by a very intricate pathway where you activate compounds in the stomach that then bind to the B12 and then are picked up in the small intestines at the terminal end of the small intestine. So if you have something like problems with Crohn's disease or inflammatory bowel disease, you have other things that have affected that terminal part of your intestines, you won't be absorbing the B12 anymore. If you have a problem with your stomach where you're not producing the compound that bind to B12, then it's never going to be picked up to be bound and taken in down below.
Then how much in general? Folic acid?
Usually it's 400, 800, and I usually tell people 800 to 1,000 or 1,200, somewhere in that range a day. So the high end. The RDAs, you have to which are listed for the vitamins, were done by making a mouse malnourished by leaving out one compound. They'd add it back a little bit at a time until they first see the benefit from it. And then at that point, they'd say that's the RDA. So usually underdose for humans. Yeah, and that's an interesting thing because it's actually quite common in people, at least having one mutation in it. And that despite that, when the supplements and so forth tend to help, because you're basically pushing, you're driving the process. People that have two severe mutations have lots and lots of problems. The cobalamin is given differently. I'm not really an expert in that area. I know just a little bit. But the cobalamin is given differently, but you do need the injections of it. You have to give forms that are sort of beyond, it's like getting the acetylcysteine directly rather than taking the B12 to make the acetylcysteine. I don't know if I helped in the... Yeah. And I'll mention another supplement that can be used in that same fashion that provides a similar benefit. Okay, so vitamin C. Linus Pauling took 10, 12 grams of vitamin C a day. That's a lot. It can make your stomach hurt. It can give you an acid-like feeling. It can make your urine very, very burning and acidy. And he said you need this because it provides good health. It prevents cancer, protects from infections, et cetera. And, he did win two Nobel Prizes, so he probably knows something. He's the only person that's won two Nobel Prizes in two different areas, for that matter. The thing is, though, that studies have never been able to replicate that vitamin C prevents colds. So lots of studies have been done. But again, as you do studies, is it the right dosing? Is it the right formulation? There's a lot of problems that arise. You can make a study end up telling you what you want it to tell by doing the things a certain way. So I don't know if it really helps with colds or not. The data I've always looked at says it doesn't really help with colds, but everybody takes it for that, and it feel like they get better. Orange juice won't give you enough, though. Orange juice will not help with a cold or prevent a cold. There's very little vitamin C overall in orange juice. So if you're going to take vitamin C, you really have to take it as a supplement. Yes, ma'am. Some people will, because again, that acid effect that occurs from it. So it's the effect, the same thing as the cranberry juice and other things have done by changing the pH of the environment. But again, those studies, when people have tried to look at those studies in a scientific manner, they've not been able to prove that that's that beneficial. So if they gather data in a certain way, they find that people that are currently having urinary tract infections, let's say take vitamin C or cranberry juice, that kind of thing, will have a reduced number of it. But now if they take people and they give them a prescribed doses of these things and then look at those that are getting a placebo instead of the real thing, they can't find any differences between those.
Would it be a regular vitamin C or
increase? It'd be increased, though. So you're talking about 5 or 6 grams a day to probably get that level. Right, so, and as we were mentioning, it can cause stomach upset, especially when you take a lot more. And so for most people, and as Teresa was just mentioning, so most, a gram a day is probably provides most people what they need to help with the approach to keeping the skin intact, keeping wounds, letting wounds heal better, and keeping the blood vessels in good shape. Yes, ma'am. I didn't mention because of the fact that there's a lot of controversy over what that should be. Most adults probably need a gram a day, and it usually comes in like 800 or 1200 or thereabout. I used to recommend 2000 milligrams or 2 grams a day, but with the cardiac recommendations, I cut that back to only a gram a day because you're probably getting some from other sources. But before you do that, you need to talk with your physician, and if you have a cardiologist, talk with them because they have varying opinions on that. But that amount, 800 to 1,000 a day for most adults, or 800 to 1,200 a day, somewhere in that range, with vitamin D and magnesium, probably they get enough calcium by that approach. And the magnesium would be about 500 milligrams a day. So minimally 250, but about 500 provides you that relaxation effect, helps the muscles and the nerves work better and feel better. And then I'll talk about the vitamin D in a moment there. So once again, you lose vitamin C in the urine, and so it doesn't build up, and so you really have to take a lot of it every day if you really want to achieve these pharmacologic effects that we've been sort of mentioning there. Okay, A and E, I mentioned these because there's, again, if you go to certain sort of what people call themselves homeopathic or complementary alternative or whatever, they'll say you need to take vitamin A and E. And usually, the good news is, though, usually how you take the vitamin A as beta-carotene, which is metabolized to vitamin A, and that's better than taking vitamin A. But I don't recommend people taking these as supplements anymore. You know, beta-carotene, you can if you want to, but and if you have certain conditions where your geneticist or physician says you need these, yes, take them. But for just routine people that are trying to provide good health, I don't recommend these anymore. Why? Vitamin A causes achiness in and around joints. If you have an arthritis condition, it makes your arthritis much worse. Yes. That would be one source of it outside of actually vitamin A pills or capsules type of thing. Yes. Okay. Vitamin E is also something that was touted for such a long time to protect us from a variety of things. Yes. It makes it worse. And that's why I quit recommend taking it. Because I would find patients that were taking vitamin A along with other supplements that were not coming under good control with their arthritis therapy, stop the vitamin A, and miraculously within days, their arthritis comes under control. Vitamin E, go ahead.
Are you talking about both for liquid
This is primarily inflammatory arthritis, so rheumatoid-type arthritis, but it'd be the conditions that are inflammatory-type arthritis. But people that are prone to arthritis conditions will get achy on vitamin A. 10% or so of the population are prone to arthritis conditions, and they will have lots of achiness due to vitamin A. Okay, go ahead. Well, yes, you can. But again, you know, all these things are not necessarily very heavily regulated. There's fizzies of it. You can get it as a stuff that will dissolve. You can dissolve the vitamin A. There's chewable tablets. You can dissolve those into a slurry and drink it. You can mix it into something else that will help the taste and so forth for you. And all. So you just have to go look. They're out there. There's all kinds of different formulations that are available. Somebody else over there? Okay. So vitamin E is, the way it's manufactured, you end up with two forms. One form is harmful. One form actually is helpful. So most vitamin E that you just go out and buy contains mixtures of things that aren't necessarily fully helpful in there. So that's why I've quit recommended it, because parts of it do bad things too. If your physician has told you to be on vitamin E for specific reasons, stay on it. But these are ones I don't recommend anymore. Vitamin D. We were taught in medical school a condition called hypervitaminosis D, because it's a fat-soluble vitamin. It will accumulate in your body. They say it will cause god-awful things if that happens. So nobody would give supplemental vitamin D. Nobody would give cod liver oil, or they'd say avoid cod liver oil because of the fact it was full of vitamin D. And you know what? They were wrong. There's no reason that you really have to restrict. Massive doses do not cause problems. This hypervitamin doses, the thing that they thought was occurring from like cod liver oil and all, is not there. I'm not sure what they actually saw 100, 150 years ago that was described as that. Every day I get these list of articles that's sent to me, what's new. So many I can't even read them all. And every day something comes in about a new use of vitamin D supplementation for a condition, or replicating that a condition that already been shown that it's worked for again. Very few of them refute the things. Very few say it's not working. So this tells me vitamin D is really important all the way around. And the RDU used to be 200, then it was jumped up to 400. Now it's around 800, but that's still too low. That's probably too low for most people that are having an issue or problem, because we're not getting the sunlight exposure to make natural vitamin D in our body the way we're supposed to. And so most people probably need at least a couple thousand a day, so in this range, and even as high as 10,000 is recommended in some. Again, do not do this at home. Talk to your doctor before you embark on doing anything like this, please. But I'm just trying to give you the facts so you have something you can think about and look at. And these are quite helpful for a variety of conditions. For the vitamin D to provide the benefit, you have to have the calcium there. For the calcium to get into you and work, you have to have the magnesium. So that's a triad that really needs to be together, the vitamin D, the calcium, and the magnesium, to really make things work the way they're supposed to. And I'm imploring you again, don't start doing any of this, taking massive doses, until you've talked to the people that are taking care of you. There's something I wanted to point out, that one of my friends that was a nephrologist 30 years ago wanted to start working on this. Why? That the T cells that we have that are so important in our immunity have vitamin D receptors. Now, vitamin D plays a role in controlling calcium, magnesium. So why does a T cell need to have a vitamin D receptor? Don't know. Nobody knows. But they're there. If they're there, they're serving some kind of a purpose. And so vitamin D has something not only beyond calcium metabolism regulation, it plays some role in helping our T cells. So I suspect now that we're pushing these higher doses, that's why we see improvement in arthritis conditions. We're probably regulating the T cells by increasing the amount of vitamin D that's coming to them, which I think is interesting. Yes? It regulates. That's the benefit of it. That's exactly the benefit. But in somebody that, say, is underactive for like, say, viral protection or something. It may increase the activity to prevent viruses and all. Now, this is not a cure for immune deficiency. This will not fix the things that are going on, but it may be beneficial and helpful in some. But before you start taking those big doses, talk to the people that take care of you to make sure they're in agreement with that. Okay. Niacin. Niacin is also a great vitamin supplement to take. Why? It makes the bad cholesterol go down and makes the good cholesterol go up. What's wrong with it? Most people, they get a flushing of the skin. That bothers them because they'll turn red for a while. Sometimes they'll get a little itchy too, and it'll be warm. But it works. It does a great job. There's also concern about toxicity of the liver. I've never seen that, so I've tried to figure out what that really was. But many people that are put on niacin for the cholesterol, they come in once a month to get their liver tested to see what's going on in their liver. So I'm not sure what exactly is going on with that, and one of these days maybe I'll understand that better. But before you use niacin to help control your cholesterol, you need to talk to your physician. Make sure they're in agreement, they understand what's going on, and they agree with that approach to the therapy. But it does work. I take niacin, my cholesterol runs 110. Yes? Yes, there are non-flushing formulations that don't lower the cholesterol. Yeah, the non-flushing ones, I don't know what they do to make it not flush, but that takes away its ability to help lower the cholesterol very well. Amino acids. This is another area that, again, would be supplemental or alternative in many ways. And I'm going to go over a few of these, but about half of the amino acids that we take have to come in our diet. We can't make them. And so they're called essential amino acids, and we have to get those from our diet. The other half can make. Now, the most essential of the amino acids is glutamine. And I have to confess that because we've stopped a little bit and all, we're running over. And if anybody needs to leave, I'll understand because it's getting close to the time they were calling the end of this session. But other ones that are probably beneficial are arginine and lysine. Another one, this relates back to the B12 that was mentioned earlier and the S-adenosylmethionine association, is N-acetylcysteine because this acts as an antioxidant and it helps to basically fortify as an alternative way into the pathways they're making the S-adenosylmethionine. So that's another way to get the benefit from down the line from that for those that are having the enzymatic inability to process B12 appropriately. But primarily we think of this as an antioxidant. So as you can tell from this metabolic chart of all the enzymatic reactions and all the chemicals and things that go on in our body, that right here in the middle somewhere is the glutamine. Glutamine is metabolized to glutamate, and the glutamate goes into every pathway that's involved. Fats, carbohydrates, protein. It's the key to us making energy. It's the key to us having life, as it turns out. So glutamine is the most important supplement, I think, that's out there. Glutamine is required to grow cells in culture. If you don't have glutamine present, the cells won't grow. In cell culture and in some animal studies, it's the only, so repeat that, only supplement that's been shown to actually cause the immune system to boost up. So again, this will be in individuals that otherwise have, quote, normal immunity, or animals that have otherwise normal immunity, that by having glutamine supplementation, you see an increase in immune activity. And so I've always suggested people take glutamine. Yes? Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. And there won't be any counteracting or any problem with that kind of a thing. Yes, great. He asked about, can you take the vitamins with antibiotics? And I said yes. And there are certain antibiotics like Bactrim or Ceftra that interfere with like B12 folic acid pathways. But it turns out you can supplement with the folic acid into B12 and not allow the bacteria to grow. It's still going to impair the growth of the bacteria. Let's see. So when you have certain inflammatory conditions, what's interesting, so like inflammatory bowel disease, it was found that if people take 2 to 4 grams of glutamine a day, they can reduce or stop their anti-inflammatory medications that's there to treat their Crohn's disease or their ulcerative colitis. And so this has been shown to be very beneficial in that context too. Again, discuss with your physician before you consider changing or altering any of your medications. Arginine is metabolized to nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is an important chemical for vasodilatation. It causes better blood flow. And so this is what allows us to get the reduction of our blood pressure and get blood flow to all the important parts of our body. So our intestines, our kidneys, our heart, our brain. Is the nitric oxide effect on the vessels is what allows this to occur. Now, you can take arginine or you can take Viagra. That's what Viagra does, is cause increase in nitric oxide. Arginine is over-the-counter, though. And this can be helpful. It probably doesn't do exactly the same thing as Viagra or those other things do, but it's basically working in the same context of increasing the nitric oxide that gets better circulation. So this is helpful. Even people with asthma, you get better circulation. It seems to be helpful in that setting too. Lysine is required for healing of wounds. Lysine allows the tissue that's growing to cross-link with each other to give strength to the tissue and to wound healing. So I like this to help get good integrity of the tissues. Lysine also is one of the things, if you take it, if you're having mouth ulcers, can help make the mouth ulcers go away. N-acetylcysteine, I was mentioning earlier, this is a sulfur-containing amino acid. This is metabolized to methionine and vice versa back and forth. And so this is what can then come into those pathways where the B12 was otherwise required that can't make it down here. You're getting on the other side of where the B12 was going to be acting in there. And so this will help fortify the acetylcysteine methionine, and this is actually the circulating antioxidant that's required in our body to try to keep the oxidation levels lower. Just a few examples of issues is we're supposed to take maybe 56 grams of protein a day. These amino acids are part of proteins, and so if you take, you know, like 4 grams of glutamine, 2 grams of arginine, 1 gram of lysine, gram of NAC, then you need to cut down your total dietary intake of protein, or it could create problems. And this is very, really important in people that are having renal disease or have problems with their kidneys. You don't want to overload your kidneys with protein, so you have to make sure if you're taking supplements like this that you're maintaining your total dietary amount of protein within the limits that are allowed by the extent of renal disease that you have. Let's go to the other supplements. So the other supplements come from a variety of sources. So from plants, algae, fish, you name it, you can probably extract a supplement from it somehow or another. The one that I think is most important are the omega-3 fatty acids, and it has lots of benefit. So one of the things that was found out several years ago was if people were given 5 grams a day, they could reduce by one half their medications they're using to treat their osteoarthritis or rheumatoid arthritis. So the anti-inflammatory nature was also helping with the pain relief that was occurring in these patients. What was also interesting many years ago, 30 grams a day were being given to patients that had bipolar disorder or other psychoses, and it would cause their psychoses to reduce or disappear. Now, taking 30 grams of omega-3s a day is really hard to do, and it makes you very fishy. You get diarrhea. It's very smelly. But it's very interesting to indicate as an indication that the antioxidant effect and anti-inflammatory effect there is helpful in a variety of conditions, even neurologic diseases that may be present. As anything else, there's always issues. Some of the studies have not shown the omega-3s to work. There's a recent study that said that omega-3 fatty acids did not help in the heart, even though many other studies have shown they help. And so it's always going to be in how you design the study, how you implement the study, is to know whether the benefits are real or not. So I still think there's plenty of evidence that says this is real. As we mentioned with the protein, we're supposed to take about 70 grams a day of fats. And so if you're taking extra omega-3 fatty acids, you need to reduce the rest of your fat intake accordingly so you can keep the overall intake down. Other supplements. And I just want to list St. John's Wort. St. John's Wort has a chemical that's very similar to Prozac. So it actually has an antidepressant in there, very similar to what we would prescribe to people as antidepressant. But it's not regulated. You don't know what the actual dose is. So if you have depression and you're taking St. John's wort to treat your depression, it's a delusion because you don't know how much you're getting. You can't regulate it. You don't know if you're at the level you really need to be at. So be very careful that don't use a supplement in lieu of a medicine that actually does provide benefit otherwise. So if you're on a good antidepressant that's working, don't say, I'm going to start taking St. John's wort instead, because it's natural, because you're going to end up not taking the right dose and your depression is going to worsen and you're going to have problems. So again, always be careful about the, even though they may have something, it may not be what you really fully need. Yeah, Bonnie.
Is there a way to know to try to come up with the best plan, or
That's a great question, and I can't remember if I have it on the next slide or not. It'll be on another slide beyond that. But the problem is they went to all the great stores in New York. They tested all these things. It did not have the ingredient in it. So there's not a way to know that. Yes. Yes, and that's part of the buyer beware that I put on there. I don't know. These things are not regulated by the FDA. They do sometimes have internal regulation, and some companies probably are being honest about what they're doing and measure and look at, and you're getting what you're buying. Other ones, all that's done is the ingredients balsamware, ground up, put in a capsule, and sold. And you may have no idea what's there. So I can't answer that directly. You'd have to investigate the company and look at what they're saying is in there, how they're testing it, and verifying that's the case. So, sorry. Yeah. That's correct. So omega-3s are found in plants and also fishes. There's a lot of controversy over the amount of other fats that are present, and it seems like the fish source provides more of what you need than the plant sources do. Echinacea, I just want to mention, people take it for colds. Studies show it doesn't work, but have they used the right doses, the right sources, etc.? It's hard to say. Many people have tried to peddle this as a cure for immune deficiency. It does not cure immune deficiency. Yes. That's correct. If it's the minerals and vitamins will have more or less what they say is in there. If it says it's 100 milligrams of vitamin C, it's going to be roughly 100 milligrams of vitamin C. If you have a capsule that says it's 60 milligrams of ginkgo biloba, you have no idea whether there's any ginkgo biloba in there or not. So it's going to be primarily these herbal supplements and plant supplements and other things like the echinacea. It may not be echinacea in the capsule. That's what's really unregulated. The omega-3s pretty much have what they say is in there. There's also a prescriptive form of omega-3 that has exactly what's in there, type of thing. So, as mentioned, ginkgo biloba, that there are many studies that have shown that reduced circulation does work, but then recently in New York, it was what was being sold as ginkgo biloba had no ginkgo biloba present in the capsules. Okay, so it's, again, buyer beware issue. Okay, so dimethyl sulfoxide, I'm going to bring up as another supplement. This is it's not really something you take internally. It's a solvent, and it's used to help deal with aches and pains. It's made by from pine tar extract, so you pull the DMSO out of that. It's not a supplement, as I say, but it's a good adjunctive therapy. It's anti-inflammatory. It can be given IV for treating urethral inflammation. So urologists use this to treat inflammation inside the body involving the genital urinary tract. It's used by veterinarians and by people that race horses to keep the horses running. So every day after they work out, they smear their legs with the DMSO to get the inflammation down. It's not FDA approved to treat tendonitis or musculoskeletal, but it works really good. And you can get it from veterinary sources. Yes?
Is there a problem with the MSO that
Yes, that's correct. And so what happens is you start smelling like garlic when you take it. And that's good because if you taste the garlic taste, you know it's getting into you. And then if you're not careful, you'll tattoo your skin because it will dissolve what's in your skin into there. So you wash yourself down real good before you put it on there. You don't cover it with any clothing because it would pull the dye from the clothing and you can make an interesting tattoo on your skin that way. Okay. Briefly, essential oils. You know frankincense from the Bible, and it does help with healing. Melaleuca, another one, it helps with healing. This has become a recent large industry, and there is like was mentioning on the networking approach to selling the things. And so one has to be very careful because these can be very expensive, but use only a small amount at a time so that the cost may be justified. But again, here you have to go through and analyze whether that it's really what's supposed to be there. So you have to know whether it's a reputable company and that the purity in the source of what is going on with it is good. And once again, this won't cure an immune deficiency. Okay. Probiotics. There's a whole list of probiotics that people use that are felt to be beneficial that can be found in multiple sources. These can come freeze-dried, they can come in yogurt or a drink called kefir. Yogurt doesn't really provide you very much of the probiotics. So the major one they advertise on TV all the time, that the people sit around talking about how much better their belly's doing, they get very little true probiotics from that, quite frankly. If you're on an antibiotic, which somebody asked earlier, you have to take more of these to try to counteract the effects because the antibiotic will likely kill the organism, so you're always trying to replenish the organisms that were there. Yes?
When going on probiotics, is it better to do it slowly, or is it like you take a recommended dosage right away?
Yeah, there's no reason to go easy on or off. If you're on an antibiotic, you might get some diarrhea because you kill the organisms and they pass through you. But there's no reason to build up to it or something like that. So these are distinct from lactose intolerance, and so the problem with that, if somebody's lactose intolerance, is that if they're trying to use yogurt or kefir, there still may be some lactose in there. Now most kefir is fermented long enough that there's no more lactose in there, so it's probably okay in that setting. Sure. So what about them? There are rare reports that infections due to the probiotic organism have occurred in patients. These have primarily been cancer patients that are neutropenic. So for those that aren't clear, neutropenia is when your white blood cell count is very low that makes you susceptible to having infections. And I've not ever heard of it happening in patients with primary immune deficiency. I think it's safe in patients with primary immune deficiency, but many immunologists will say avoid them because they're worried about them. And so that's always an issue. Yes? Not exactly. Okay. So unpasteurized milk has other organisms that can be helpful, but also can be harmful in there. When we look at it, in individuals that have no other immune issues, and you look at those that were raised on unpasteurized milk versus pasteurized milk, there are less allergies and asthma present in those using unpasteurized milk. There's less. But that's only in that kind of a setting, and that has to do with a whole other series of different things. That's exposure to pathogens early in life that you build up stronger immunity to against the pathogen rather than building up an allergy instead. So I would not recommend unpasteurized milk at all to an immune deficiency patient. Yes. Let me see if I understand the question. The question, I think, was is it better to use a multitude of the organisms? Yes, you want something that has a multitude. The main one at the top, the Lactobacillus bifidus, is the main one, but most think that, and Just as each one of us might like, you know, there's people like Coke, there's people like Pepsi, okay? So too, some organisms might work better in some people than other ones do. So having a mixture will allow for the things that work best for an individual to happen, type of thing. Yes? I don't know which is better than another one. I can say I buy mine from GNC, you know, and that I use. But I think that, you know, you can look and see, and if it's from a reputable source, it should be what's there, type of a thing. Again, I think it's probably safe. More recently, there's what's called fecal microbiota transplantation, and that's a whole separate issue of taking normal stool from patients that have no problems, concentrating it down, and then feeding that to people that have problems. There's been a lot of issues with this. The FDA now is allowing it. There will be products out where there will be capsules of this sometime in the near future. It's helpful for C. diff infections, which can be a problem in primary immune deficiencies. And so I think that can be something very helpful. There's benefit that's been shown in inflammatory bowel disease by using these. And it helps restore what we call the normal gut flora in a variety of conditions. This may even be better than the quote probiotics because it's giving the things that normally should be there. This was done 30 years ago in bone marrow transplants. Every time you gave a lot of chemotherapy, antibiotics, that you gave the new marrow for the patient, and you gave them you took flora that was present from normal people, you actually squirted it into their intestines. You didn't have them drink it, but you squirted it back into their intestines to repopulate their intestines with their normal flora. So it's not new. Chiropractic care, just wanted to mention, for biomechanical problems, I think it's useful and helpful. If your chiropractor is saying that I'll cure your asthma, your diabetes, you know, I would go somewhere else because I don't think it does that. Just like with anything else, what are called mock adjustments, where they fake doing the adjustment versus a real adjustment, showed the same benefit in trials. So people say that chiropractic help doesn't work. But I think in general, if you have biomechanical disease, you can get benefit from it. If you have a good chiropractor, they will work with you. Acupuncture studies have demonstrated benefit, how it works. Nobody knows for sure in there. Should be performed by somebody that's well-trained, though, and you want disposable needles and so forth because there's potential for infection risk. Hypnotism works. Subject has to be motivated. The effects can wear off rapidly in some people, so you can get benefit that's prolonged in some individuals. Other ones, it can wear off. So frequently, you have to do frequent sessions to keep the benefit going. And this is very, very helpful, in my experience, to deal with pain issues as well as anxiety. And I don't have time to tell you more anecdotes or testimonials about that, but if somebody wants to talk to me later, I can give some other testimonials. And what I promised some people that after the session is over, we're going to do a hypnosis relaxation for anxiety reduction for anybody that would like to stay a little bit longer. Yes?
One more question. Is there a vitamin or a supplement that you can take that would reduce the glucose levels?
For diabetes type of thing? I don't know. Glutamine is what results in glucose utilization in the tricarboxylic acid cycle. It may, I don't know. I haven't seen anything about that, but that would be the only thing I know that at least fits directly into the pathways. Yes? I'm sorry, Sam.
Emotional freedom?
Oh, yeah. I know some about it, using autism and so forth, but I don't know a lot, so sorry. Okay, so placebo effects. 60% of the time there's a big placebo effect in individuals. So a lot of the supplements, a lot of the things that are done are a consequence of just the fact that somebody wants it to happen. So always be aware that what you may be thinking is a beneficial effect may just be the placebo effect. The complementary medicine, there are numerous approaches, modalities, ingredients. Many of these are from natural sources. They can be beneficial, but I would like to say the industry's not regulated, so we have to think about BioBeware in this. And just to remember, do you remember there's a movie Space Jam with Michael Jordan when he quit basketball the first time? and they were losing. So Bugs got the Michael's secret stuff, which was water that he got out of the water fountain, and everybody drank it, and suddenly they got all big and powerful and could play basketball like Michael Jordan. So the placebo effect is very strong in individuals. Again, numerous predictions and so forth that we were mentioning. Testimonials are not a reason to believe, and I've used testimonials today with you to try to help explain some of the things that are going on. Many items are useful, some can be harmful, and unfortunately the wrong thing may be placed in a product, or the product might not contain what it says it contains. So always just be very careful. I limit myself to a very small number of things that I feel comfortable with. I don't explore other things that are coming online, because I think if it's already been useful, we've known about it for 1,000 years. The amino acid supplements, I think, are safe and are helpful. Omega-3 fatty acid, I think, are safe and helpful. And these are part of our normal diet. So we're not doing anything except supplementing what normally would have been there. Whenever we're doing these things, though, we always have to be careful that we're not harming ourselves if we have kidney or other metabolic issues where these things like this could be problematic. So always want to discuss and make sure that you're doing the right thing. Minerals and vitamins are also very helpful. Take care so you don't make yourself toxic. Natural supplements can be helpful. But again, unregulated, you have to take care. I mention these things over and over because I want to reinforce that message that we have to take care. Probiotics are probably good and probably okay in most people. And I'm not worried about probiotics in patients with primary immune deficiency, except for those with neutropenia or neutrophil disorders. I may have some reservation depending on what else is going on with that. Chiropractic care, acupuncture, hypnotism can be useful in many people and can provide some other needs that aren't being met by the traditional approach to medicine. One of the things I've mentioned here is that seeking out a good naturopathic physician, there's an organization where they're policing themselves that trying to maintain high standards. So you can seek this out, check with them, talk with them, learn about what might be helpful for you. But you always have to be careful there too, because some of the things are done by testimonial approach rather than by scientific rigorous study approach. Traditional Chinese medicine, again, can be very useful, but you don't want somebody that's taken an internet course that's learned how to do it, because they probably aren't going to give you the right thing or be that helpful. Always discuss with your physician and immunologist, and you want to deal with this in a manner that can work together as a team to try to get the beneficial effects and not generate any harm in the process. So I'm sorry we went over, but I thought it would be better to answer questions along the way.